You're listening to Let's Talk, a bi-weekly supplement to our regular podcast because you watch where we talk movies, films and cinema, or whatever we're obsessed with at the moment. As always, I'm Charlie.
And I'm Francesco.
Francesco, let's talk.
This hit goes out to you, Mr. Wicked.
42 regular, wasn't it?
Yeah. And so it begins.
Yeah.
Challenge you to single combat.
If you win, you'll have your freedom. And when I see you, I'm gonna take what
I want, so. Amen.
Ah, what a nice trailer.
I actually haven't seen the trailer for this film.
But we just played it.
Well, that's the magic of editing.
Oh, that's true.
We're not on radio.
So if you don't know already, we are talking about the newest addition to the John Wick series, John Wick Chapter 4, directed by Chad Stahelski. It is a 2023 film. It is 169 minutes long.
And worth the entire runtime.
Oh, it chugs along like a choo-choo train. Mm-hmm. With the price on his head ever increasing, John Wick uncovers a path to defeating the High Table. But before he can earn his freedom, Wick must face off against a new enemy, the Marquis de Gramont, with powerful alliances across the globe and forces that turn old friends into foes.
Here's how you make a villain detestable. Make him a royal and make him French.
And throw in a Skarsgård for good measure.
God.
I will say that the Marquis played here by Bill Skarsgård is a wonderful villain, and as detestable as he is, his fashion is very consistently on point.
Oh, if he was 10% gayer, he'd be an icon.
You don't think he's gay enough?
He is, but he doesn't know it yet.
Yeah, it's not. He's camp rather than...
He's metrosexual, if the word
so exists. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. There is something, like, detestably straight about him.
Yeah. Well, I still hate him in spite of his outfits.
Oh, completely. No, he's there to be hated because where John Wick is this sort of bastion of integrity and, you know, diligence, he is someone that delegates all his dirty work to underlings.
Yeah.
And gets annoyed when they don't do everything he wants all the time.
Like a true aristocrat. Anyway, the film.
I saw this on Sunday. When did you see it?
On Sunday as well. In the evening, though. You saw it in the afternoon.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
We didn't see it at the same time.
No, we didn't see it together.
No, we didn't see it together, but you were invited.
I was, but I'm moving houses and I still work on Sundays sometimes.
So you didn't want to travel that far.
It's a 3-hour movie.
That's true. But no, I saw it with friend of the podcast, Fionn Krieber.
And I saw it by myself. And should we ask Fionn for a voice note with his thoughts, since he's been name dropped and he's part of this?
Yeah, sure.
We're going to play that at some point.
Also, just for... Oh, let's play it now.
Okay. Hi, Fionn Krieber here. Here to discuss John Wick 4 for you. Good people who listen to the Because You Watch podcast. I feel that John Wick 4 could best be surmised by observing the sartorial choices. Now, the John Wick series has always had a very strong visual aesthetic attached to all its characters. People really, really look like they're murderers. And within that, you have Tracker, who dresses like someone who's used to being out and about, which hides his teleportation powers. You have Rina Sawayama removing her more traditional Japanese garb to reveal a murder cat suit. You have John Wick in his consistent three-piece suits, briefly removed, then reattached. It's beautiful. It all works so nicely. And nowhere in this movie, and in any of these four movies, which I love very dearly, the visual aesthetic so well managed than it is with Bill Skarsgård. Bill Skarsgård's Marquis de Gramont looks like a bastard man. He looks like someone you hate. He wears a sparkly three-piece suit. He is very rarely seen not in tails, and I swear to Christ he has a new costume for every single time he appears in this movie, which is a surprisingly large amount. Well, not that surprising. He is the sort of antagonist of the film, the main antagonist. And he, every time he appears, it is in the most ostentatious bastard attire. And I think that, if anything, says a lot about this film, that the fact that you look at someone and you're just like, you're a bastard, you're the biggest bastard here, but I also know you can't fight. And the fact that he can't fight means that ultimately, in the John Wickiverse, well, I'm not going to spoil it for you. This has been my thoughts on John Wick 4.
I genuinely don't think I'd have enjoyed this movie as much on my own. And I go to the cinema alone a lot, and I tend to have a really good time, but there is something about losing your shit when certain people come on screen or when a certain thing happens.
Well, here comes Boomerant. I was sitting next to the least disciplined cinema goers ever. They were talking throughout the entire film. Then at one point they even took their phone out to read their messages, which any other film would have annoyed me much more. This film, I saw it, I think, on the biggest view screen in the view nearby. And the just most of it, the sound was loud enough to like drown out any crowd noises. But it's something that comes when a film is so popular, a lot of casual viewers who don't really know cinema etiquette go see it. And you have to deal with that.
I mean, not to gatekeep, but that's kind of what this podcast can be sometimes. I think if you're going to see John Wick Chapter 4 and you are not glued to the screen the whole time, no matter what kind of viewer you are, I can't get angry at you. I just kind of feel bad because you don't have that in your life.
I guess, and
it sounds like I'm taking the piss, but there is something very sincere and very exciting about going to see this kind of film.
Well, that's Sunday night audiences for you. They're casuals.
That's true. I mean, on a Sunday night I went to see M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin.
Okay.
And I saw that on my own. And when I say on my own, I don't just mean I didn't go with anyone. I meant there were two other people in the cinema.
Oh, wow.
Makes movies for very little, so he can make his money back.
Well, he's busy. He self-funds them, basically, right?
Yeah, and it's paid off.
Well, there you go.
Anyway, that's not... we're not talking about Knock at the Cabin today. But, yeah, this movie, I mean, I kind of don't know where to start, and I don't want to spoil it too much, but needless to say, Keanu Reeves is back. He's 58.
Yeah.
And still going strong. But for some reason, it's not just because he's younger than these guys, but I know Bruce Willis is retired, but I think he's a big example. Or Sylvester Stallone.
Or Tom Cruise.
Big one.
Yeah.
There's something about him doing it where I'm not like, oh, come on, give it a rest. You should give it up. There's something that is so him about John Wick.
Well, I think this movie kind of incorporates his aging. He is, and that's not a dig on his performance, I think it's probably planned. He does move a bit more slowly and methodically than in the previous film. Also, like this, you know, completely, I wouldn't worry about spoilers for the previous entries, but the last film literally ends with him being riddled with bullets and thrown off a roof. He's not going to be in his A game throughout this film, even though he's recovered by the time this starts.
Yeah, but it's not like... You've seen Skyfall, right?
I have, but I haven't seen Spectre.
Okay, well, I asked you about Skyfall.
Oh, I thought you were talking about, I don't know, the ending of Skyfall and the...
No, what I mean is that so much of Skyfall is about how Daniel Craig's James Bond is past his prime.
Okay.
I don't think John Wick Chapter 4 ever does that because he's not like a shadow of his former self, partly because we never actually saw him as young John Wick. I mean, the first John Wick was 10 years ago. He was already in his late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it has a cultural legacy of what Keanu Reeves' movies used to be. But to be honest, he wasn't really known as like a martial arts film star until much later in his life, even though there is martial arts in The Matrix.
I guess what I'm saying is that it's not explicit. You know, even Tom Cruise in Top Gun Maverick, they address the fact that he's aged. Here it's not explicit, but he takes a lot more punches and kicks to the face than the previous film. He's visibly struggling a bit more and he's getting kicked around a lot more, which is, you know, it's subtle, it's not the point of the film, but I'm pretty sure with how meticulous the choreographers are in this film that it was deliberate that he's not as much of a super machine in this one.
Yeah, and he's also up against better villains. And I don't mean better as in the other ones are worse, but villains who are more of a physical threat.
Yeah.
It's kind of like The Dark Knight Rises, where you have simultaneously a Batman that is out of shape and out of practice and a bit past his prime, and the most physically dangerous villain he's faced so far. And here you have, I would argue he's up against at least two villains that are, not villains, but two antagonists that are a physical threat to him in a way that I don't know if we've seen before in the series. Mm-hmm. And they are the most obvious one is Donnie Yen as Kane, who is, I would say Donnie Yen is fantastic in this film.
Oh, he's amazing. And he's less of a villain and more of a rival.
No, I said antagonist. Yeah. He's an obstacle.
Oh, no, because I know who the other one you're going to bring up is, and he's definitely a villain.
Yeah, okay, sure. Yeah. Scott Adkins as Keeler. Scott Adkins, who is, you know, a great stunt performer and martial artist in this quite good fat suit.
I didn't even know it was a fat suit until you mentioned
it. Until I knew it was Scott Adkins, I didn't know.
Yeah.
But he's got... And
he's still able to, like, move and fight in it.
Yeah, and it just gives him, like, a lot of heft.
Yeah.
And that is one of the best action scenes in the film.
But I guess that's my point. Like, maybe one of the previous films, that fight kind of happens at the midpoint of the film, I want to say. And that's when, and you have to correct me if I'm wrong here, because I haven't seen the previous films in years. But that's kind of when in the previous films you would either get him just completely overpowering an enemy, or just him being outnumbered by a bunch of other enemies and just, you know, going through them. Whereas here, there's this guy who, like, he's not even introduced as a fighter, who just almost, you know, does away with it.
Well, he's introduced as a bit of a cipher at first.
Mm.
And then you kind of get his deal pretty quickly, and it's like, oh, this guy is another John Wick level badass.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really cool. I mean, just to talk on that scene, we'll go back, so I want to talk about the Osaka scene. But the scene in Berlin, I think it is. Yeah, it's Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so bonkers. It's so wonderful.
They're shooting each other in this packed nightclub full of people dancing.
Who continue to dance.
Yeah.
And they start running away more when they get pushed into, rather than because of gunshots or because anything drastic happens. I think that scene's wonderful, and I do like the silliness of everyone still dancing.
I think that's one of the things I love the most about the John Wick movies, is that these bonkers assassins fighting each other, scraps are like thrown in the middle of like locations and public streets. I'm not going to spoil it too much. My favorite sequence in the entire film is the one around the Arc de Triomphe in that roundabout.
Oh, really?
Maybe not my favorite sequence, but like just shooting an action scene on that roundabout with like cars driving
around. It's called Carfu.
Carfu, is that what it's called?
Yeah, no, literally, yeah. It's a trope.
Oh, wow. But because that's, I think it was in John Wick 3 or 2 where Keanu Reeves mentioned that the only stunt he did in the entire film that either injured him or like had a risk of, like a very high risk of injury, is where a car runs him over. And they do it several times in this film. And every time I was like, what the fuck? Like, the one stunt you mentioned that put your life in danger, you're just repeating it like fivefold in this new movie.
Yeah, but he's not on a horse this time.
He doesn't get, when he gets run over by a car in the previous film, he's not on a horse either.
No, but he does ride a horse in the last film.
True. He rides a horse in this one as well, at the beginning, in the desert.
Oh, yeah, but not like, it's not an extended, it's him on a horse, it's not a fight sequence where he happens to be on a horse.
Yeah, he doesn't fall off the horse or anything.
Yeah, he's... So this movie, I genuinely don't really know where to go with it. I mean, we talk like just a bit about Keanu Reeves as a movie star. What's your relationship with him as an actor like?
Knew him from the Matrix movies.
Yeah.
Before John Wick, I think that was about it. Because I've actually never seen the Bill and Ted movies.
Okay.
I've never seen a lot of the stuff that he was in when he was younger.
Okay. I mean, have you seen Bram Stoker's Dracula?
No, to my shame.
Okay, that is a bonkers performance in a bonkers movie.
Mm.
And it kind of, I would argue it doesn't work, but it is worth watching anyway. And there is stuff to kind of, if you like Keanu Reeves, it's good to watch in retrospect.
Well, I'll tell you the movies I've seen with him: the John Wick movies, the Matrix movies, and Toy Story 4.
See, I haven't seen Toy Story 4.
Oh,
he plays Duke Kaboom.
Yeah, he plays a stuntman.
But yeah. A character like John Wick is a very understated character, but the world and what that character is able to do is very over the top, and I don't think it works without his specific energy.
And yeah, I think to bring it back to the film for a bit, that's kind of what I really loved about this entry in the franchise, because I worried going from 1 to 2 to 3 back to back a few years ago, and how much more expansive and how much more bonkers than the previous one they get, that they were just going to continue up in the stakes and adding more lore and adding more complicatedness to the whole system of the International Assassins organization, whatever.
And but you don't think this does that?
I don't think it does. I think it adds some lore. There's the whole through line of the duo, and obviously the Marquis is a newly introduced character. But we basically have the established lore and structure from the third one, and we take that and go into a much more character-focused movie. Not just focused on John Wick's character, but his two foils, his two rivals, Kane, that we already mentioned, and Nobody.
Yeah, who we will talk about in a sec. But I just, to your point, I think this does add a lot of lore, but I think that it's been a while since I've seen the third one, but arguably only adds as much as is needed for this particular story.
Yeah.
It's not lore and world building for the sake of lore and world building. It's this is what's happening, and this is what you need to know about the world in order to make sense of it.
Also, if you've seen the end of the third one, you kind of expect that he is gonna go up, maybe not directly against, but his foe is now the High Table, the Assassin's organization itself. So the lore that is built around them is not as this background entity who's moving things from the shadow, but is as the active antagonist to this film.
And he's very active and very visible.
Well, yeah. Well, is the Marquis part of the High Table himself, or is he a friend?
No, I think he's part of the High... It's never quite clear, I think, but he's... part of the High Table who's given, like, executive power. Hmm. He's given, like, emergency override powers. Which is kind of like, you know, how the actual origin of, say, the term dictator is that you had dictatorial power for a set period of time in order to achieve a certain thing.
Yeah.
So they essentially suspend the High Table to allow the Marquis to exercise complete control in order to bring down John Wick.
Hmm.
So I have a question about how that works, because in all these movies, I don't know if I've ever seen them actually kill someone that isn't part of the Assassin's world. I don't know how their internal economy works.
Well, I think it's through the hotels, it must be.
So you just think it's real estate? investing in the hospitality industry. But also, most people who go to the hotels are assassins.
And they use their own currency. Well, they're aristocrats, I think, is the thing. It's like a lot of inherited wealth. And I think people must be able to, like, commission them. Like, civilians must be able
to. But it's so funny that we never really see that side of it.
No, because we're following John Wick, and he's, like, he's got half his foot out of it. But my assumption is that, like, actual aristocracy. But that's why I'm not sure how much the Marquis is like a member of the table himself. He's clearly like involved with them and knows the lore, but I'm sure there are like plenty of other aristocrats or very rich capitalists or politicians who just like use their money to hire these assassins.
I'm just saying that every person in the assassins world, I almost called it the Assassin's Guild, which is Assassin's Creed. Everyone in that world seems to be either carrying out kills for the sake of blood feuds, or they're in the hospitality sector.
You know what it is, and you're going to have to bear with me on this one.
Okay, go.
It's Harry Potter.
Okay.
So
you're saying it's bad world building?
No, it's good. If Harry Potter was good. So the first Harry Potter, what's the premise?
John Wick is right. If Harry Potter was good. Okay, yeah. We'll go with that. Okay, I'll humor you.
So first Harry Potter.
Go.
What's kind of the premise of that? Oh, what if there was a magical world that was like parallel to our own, that like only a few people could access, but like it's fun, and a lot of people love it because like it helps you imagine what if, you know, I could be whisked away from my sad life and be thrown into this parallel magical world. The problem with the Harry Potter movies is that, or books or whatever, is that as they start getting more adult and more having to deal with real world issues, then you kind of have to justify a few things. And you have stuff like J.K. Rowling saying, well, the wizards could have stopped the Holocaust but chose not to. This series, John Wick, it's kind of the same thing. What if there was a parallel world made up of assassins that kind of existed in a similar plane as ours, but they had their own currency, they had their own, like, you know, set of rules and stuff like that. But I think they don't really need to be interacting with the real world, or we can imagine the ways in which they interact with the real world without us ever like being taken out of this parallel universe and into the real world for any reason.
I just love the idea of these assassins just sort of like huddled at a conference looking at spreadsheets over the intake, because the only way they seem to be making any money is off the hotels.
Also, there's the thing that the hotels use their own currency.
Well, like, I wonder if that's like for a certain sort of guest,
or if that I don't remember, that's kind of the thing that they established in the first ones. I wonder if that currency is less something that you used to pay and more something that you used to prove that you're part of the...
Yeah, I mean, also all the hotel staff are assassins. There's not like one person in the catering side that's like, wait, what's going on?
That would be so funny. But it's kind of a necessary thing, right? Because like if someone does break the rules, like you need like someone to enforce them.
Oh, you don't need to justify it. I love it.
It would be so funny if there was like,
there was, like
a cleaner.
Yeah, he was like... with the trolley with soaps and everything, and there's just like a fight going on in the
hallway. Someone like steals his mop and uses it to like murder someone else, and he's just like, "What? I need that."
Well, there's a brilliant scene. I think it's in the second one. Oh god, I haven't rewatched the first 3 or 4 days, but there's that scene where it's John Wick and another guy chasing each other in a public street. And at one point, I think they're in a train station and they're shooting each other with silencer guns, like from far away in the middle of a crowd. And like no one can hear the guns. And like it's justified that like no one is aware that there's these two guys shooting bullets at each other in the middle of a packed station. But oh god.
So that brings me on to my favorite section is quite early in the film, is the whole sequence in Osaka.
Oh, well, that's beautifully lit.
Yeah, I mean, in the Osaka Continental, he's there. He is seeking refuge with his friend Shimazu, played by Hiroyuki Sanada.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, wonderful actor who I know best, actually, from the Danny Boyle film Sunshine. But other people probably know him from The Last Samurai or The Wolverine. And so he basically runs the Osaka Continental. He's the Japanese Ian McShane.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as a certain thing happened, I was so excited. Do you have any idea what that might be?
Is that when he... Well, I'll tell you what made me excited.
Okay.
When he went to the kitchen where a lot of the staff were like drinking and playing cards, and he tells them, "We have guests, be ready to welcome them." And they open up a cupboard filled with katanas. That made me really excited.
And bows and arrows.
And bows and arrows, of course.
What excited me even more than that was the appearance of a samurai SWAT team.
Oh, wow, yeah.
That was some cool
with
shit.
With the samurai masks.
They had, like, samurai
masks
and helmets, but in the like Kevlar material. It's just little touches like that, which is so silly, but so necessary for this sort of film to work. And I just squealed when I saw it. I was so happy.
Something that made me very excited was his daughter, Akira, played by Rina Sawayama, when she takes a concierge suit off and she's got just a fighter's bodysuit and a bow and arrow, and that's my biggest disappointment in the film. She's not in a lot of it.
No, but she's very present in that section.
Yeah, but I thought she was going to be there throughout the rest of the film.
Sure, but she's so cool.
I wanted more of her.
Are you a fan of her music?
No, I didn't know her.
No, she sings really like the song that goes over the credits.
Oh, okay.
She's known as a singer.
Yeah, I my first time seeing her was in this film.
Yeah, Rina Sawayama. She is really wonderful, really cool, and I want her to beat me up.
Yeah, who wouldn't?
She's a lot of fun.
I love a woman that could actually kill me.
No, she's lovely, and she's very good with a bow and arrow.
Well, yeah.
She'd have to be.
And yeah, to be in that world, to be an assassin, to be a concierge in that world.
In that order.
Yeah. Well, speaking of concierge, there's the elephant in the room in this film, which is the Lance Reddick character.
Yeah.
Who, I hope it's not spoiler to say, the character dies fairly early on in the film. And we know that people weren't expecting the actor to pass away. Like, he came out of the blue. But there's something very emotional about watching this film where his character is killed off in the first 10 minutes to up the stakes and to introduce the villain, basically. But that means that his death kind of hangs over the entire film, and especially Winston's character, who gives him a wonderful eulogy later on. And I don't know, watching this with the death of the actor himself in mind moved me a lot.
No, I mean, I love Lance Reddick. I can't wait to see him in the new Percy Jackson series, which apparently he finished filming all his scenes for. He plays Zeus.
Oh, wow.
So very, very good casting there. But yeah, I think you're right. When that happened, it kind of made me wonder, oh, is this sort of like his plan out because he was ill and he couldn't do much? But no, because he was doing press up until a few weeks before he died.
He like, was later to go to the movie premiere like 2 days after he passed. So.
Yeah, it's such... You know, it's such a loss. And he wasn't particularly old. It's just very sad.
Yeah.
And he's just a wonderful, wonderful actor.
Yeah.
I'll always remember him from the Eric Andre Show.
I was about to say.
Which is truly one of the most hilarious sketches on that show. And I love that show.
I mean, the fact that he took over the Eric Andre Show.
And scared Eric Andre. It's so good.
Not very many people could do that. But then, you know, other than him, we have a lot of new characters that are introduced. We mentioned Akira. We briefly mentioned Kane, but...
Played by Donnie Yen.
Played by Donnie Yen.
And when he turned up And so his character is blind in this film. And because, to be honest, I mainly know Donnie Yen from Star Wars Rogue One, and he's blind in that, and it got me thinking, is he blind in real life? Because he's in both of those films, he's played like a martial arts blind guy, which I know is a trope, but it was just very funny.
Yeah, but I think, which brings me back to the action in this film, a lesser film, or maybe not necessarily a lesser film, but a more tropey film would have made the blind martial arts guy into a superhero with super hearing and super smell who could fight just as well, if not better, than any of the guys who can actually see.
No, he's got gadgets.
Yeah, his blindness is incorporated in the way he fights. When he shoots guns, he's like randomly shooting hope into his target.
But he has these like little things which set off alarms so he knows where people are. That's yeah. really funny.
And oh God. And then I think...
You're right, he's not Daredevil.
No. Exactly. Ooh, Daredevil, he can, like, literally see.
Yeah, Daredevil's a dumb cat. I love Daredevil, but, like, the blind guy, but he can hear so well that he can basically see.
I think there's a scene in the first season of Daredevil, which is the only one I actually saw, where, oh, someone who doesn't know he's a superhero, like, she literally brings up, wait, you can see. Like, she literally tells him to his face.
Yeah, and you see from his point of view what he can see, and it's just, he's colorblind.
Yeah.
Daredevil's, like, disability is that he's colorblind.
But no, but Kane's blindness is incorporated into the choreography, and his character is so interesting because he's an antagonist. He's a rival to John Wick. He's almost a foil to John Wick, where...
Yeah, I'd call him a foil.
Yeah, John Wick is at his point... You know, ever since the first film, you could say that John Wick is at a point in his life where he's basically got nothing to lose, but he's been driven by his anger and his thirst for revenge. Kane is someone who has something to lose. He's got a daughter that he cares about, which means that he can be bought and manipulated. But that doesn't make him evil or dishonorable. There's a moment early on where he kills off a character who is undoubtedly one of the good guys. And he wins the fight against this character and he's about to spare him. But then the other character is about to... get in a, you know, crap shot, a cheap shot from the back, and Kane, you know, uses that to, like, retaliate and kill him. You never see him kill innocents or kill someone who doesn't deserve it, and the reason why he's on this path to go after John Wick is that he needs to protect his daughter, and that is such an interesting antagonist to me, because I can still root for him, despite the fact that he's an antagonist.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that John Wick doesn't have anything to lose except for his will to keep going.
Mm.
And if he gives that up, I'd argue the first two films, he is, like you said, he's driven by want for revenge. And by the end of it, he doesn't really have a choice. He's fighting for a way out. And it's not a spoil. It happens later in the film, but it's in the trailer. But Ian McShane's Winston says, however this goes, you have your freedom. Because either you'll take out the high table, or you'll die.
Yeah.
So either way, you'll get what you want. I think what's more interesting from a narrative perspective is how does he reconcile that with defeating and potentially killing a guy that is, you know, his friend.
Yeah.
And yes, he's an obstacle. And yes, Kane is a problem for him. But is it worth killing someone that you know to be a good and honourable person in order for you to continue living? And they never have a moment where they discuss this, but I think that's the subtext of the film, is the entire film is a moral dilemma for John Wick of what happens when the people sent to fight me aren't just terrible people or aren't just doing it because they want the money.
And it's a brilliant achievement of the film that we've never met Kane before this. He's introduced to us as supposedly an old friend of John Wick, and we're supposed to buy it, but yet we still feel that history between them, and we still feel that respect between them.
Yeah, and it also helps that, you know, the main villain, the Marquis, he's malevolence personified.
God.
He's so hammy and he's so camp and he's so evil that whoever you put up against him, even if he's not played by someone with, like, a real sweet energy like Donnie Yen has, it means that whoever you put against him will look pretty tame by comparison, as long as they're not just, you know, a tough or a henchman, which he does have. And so you don't feel bad when that guy dies because he seems to be, you know, in on it and willfully doing it. Whereas, yeah, having the main obstacle be someone who doesn't have a choice but to win. It's great, and I don't think these movies have done that before.
And I think that's what's so interesting about Kane and the Marquis as antagonists, because in a way, they're both institutionalists. They both represent the high table and the system that John Wick wants to overthrow. But Kane is someone who is an institutionalist because he has no alternative. He, you know, he criticizes the system, yet he lives in it. But he has to abide by this system because it's the only way that he can survive. Whereas the Marquis is someone who is respectful of the institution and the system, but willing to twist and bend the rules to his advantage.
He's lawful evil.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas in D&D more, terms.
Kane is more of like lawful neutral, you could say. Whereas John Wick is chaotic good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. John Wick kind of, and it's a trope, you know, plays by his own rules,
yeah.
Because it's like no one else is playing fair, so why should he abide by any rules? Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting, and I think I'd love to rewatch all of them with sort of that in mind and the moral questions of the series. Yes, it's a brilliant action series and sequence of fight scenes, but at its heart, I think it is, I genuinely believe that it is concerned sincerely with questions like that.
And it kind of brings a lot of it back to the first film. Not the second and third one didn't do that, but there are a lot of moments here where we are so explicitly reminded of John Wick's wife, who, you know, she got fridged before the first film even started, but she is the inciting incident for this whole quadrilogy to happen.
Oh, okay. Can I just jump in here? John Wick's wife is not fridged, and let me explain.
Okay.
Fridging, as coined by Gail Simone, mm-hmm. is the practice of killing off a character, usually a female love interest, solely in order to motivate a male character. What is worth pointing out is that she dies before the inciting incident. Who actually gets fridged is his wife's dog.
Is the dog. Who is an embodiment of his wife?
Agreed, but it's the wife herself isn't fridged. True. She's a tragic, you know, lost love interest character, which is, you could argue, is problematic in its own way, but it's not quite fridging, and I think that our listeners will appreciate the distinction.
Yeah, but I guess that's kind of the thing that we have at the very beginning of John Wick. He loved his wife, and he loves dogs. Those are his two main traits, and he kills people.
He loves killing.
And well, he doesn't really, like, he kind of has to do it.
You know what? I think he's having fun. I think he's having fun out there.
I mean, yeah, what else is he going to do?
Like, it's not that he missed killing, but it's like, you know, it's like if you've not gone really hard on a night out before and used to really enjoy it, but, you know, you got married and you had kids, but then you go on a stag do, and you go really hard for, like, a weekend. You're like, I really used to enjoy this. I wasn't pining for it, and my life would be the same if I didn't have it. But I appreciate the opportunity to relive a thing I used to do. I don't think John Wick hates killing.
It's Monday and you have a headache and you have to go to work because you're an adult now.
Well, arguably, John Wick 3 and 4 is the hangover. Wick 1 and 2 is the stag do.
But I guess my point was that the stakes in the first film are very small, very simple. I don't want to call them cliche, but, you know, they're nothing new.
They're very contained.
And then, you know, it goes up and up and up and up until the third one, like, explodes with this, like, huge international assassin system.
It becomes Kung Fu James Bond.
Yeah.
Kind of.
It's very James Bondy, and this one is as well. But, you know, it was James Bondy from the first one with the, like, colorful accented villains and all of that. But then, yeah, it becomes, like, international espionage kind of thing. Here, we still have those elements of, like, we're going to Osaka, we're going to Berlin, we're going to New York.
We're going to Paris.
We have, you know, a French accented flamboyant villain. But
played by a Swede.
He's, we're brought back to those stakes a little bit. We're brought back to his love for his wife. We're brought back to his love for dogs, which plays a huge role in this film. And it's nice to be reminded that this, you know, the first film is still part of the same series in a way. And it's very circular in this way. It's very cohesive. I was worried when finishing the third one that by the time we got to the fourth or fifth, it was going to be like a completely different movie than what we bargained for at the beginning. But no, this film maintains the lore established in the third one, but doesn't forsake its roots.
Yeah, I think it reconciles it. Mm. And I also think that John Wick 4 is the most we've we've got of a pre-John Wick 1 John Wick since, you know, the first one, I think it does come back around. And you're right, I think there is a switch that gets pulled at the end of John Wick 1 or between 1 and 2 where he is, you know, the badass assassin. Mm-hmm. And you don't really see... You see a bit, but you don't see that much of the John Wick from the beginning of the first movie.
Yeah, and his friendship with Kane comes into that as well, because that predates the first John Wick.
Oh, of course, yeah. And another thing I'll say about Kane, and I actually think this is an achievement of the score of this film, is that with Kane and Shimazu, it never sort of drifts, even though these characters are shown to be honourable people who are very skilled in martial arts, they never sort of fall into like a ninja or samurai stereotype. Mm-hmm. They all feel like very specific characters that, yes, reference tropes of Japanese and Chinese action movies, but it never sort of falls into the trap of them being a cliche.
Well, because in the third one, we have the two Indonesian guys who were stuntmen and action fighters in the films The Raid, The Raid 2. And they, I haven't seen The Raid, but from what I hear, they behave very much like their characters in The Raid.
Right.
They do all the same stunts. Whereas here, no, you're right. They feel like their own characters in this universe. They don't feel, you know, referential to anything else.
Maybe it's recency bias, but I do feel like those two characters will stick with me more than those characters that you mentioned in the third one.
Yeah, because they're voiceless in the third one. They don't really have a character.
Yeah, but I would say they are more in line with Halle Berry's character, who... in that, I think it's set in Casablanca with the dogs, and that's and I was sad she didn't come back, but I do kind of enjoy it. It is kind of James Bondy, and like, oh, he has a friend in this place, he has a connection in this place, and he has this regular cast of allies or contentious allies. With, we haven't mentioned Lawrence Fishburne plays Bowery King just chewing pieces of scenery and pulling it out of his teeth. And obviously Ian McShane, and for the other films, Lance Reddick. Mm-hmm. So he has sort of that central core, but he can go from place to place and run into people who remind him of a different aspect of his past life. And it is very James Bondy, but in a really bonkers and interesting way.
And if you were more James Bondy, we could have had, you know, the Wick Girl of each film with Halle Berry and Rina Sawayama here. But no, John Wick just loves his wife too much to be unfaithful to her.
John Wick is a weirdly asexual character.
He's just very monogamous. And,
yeah, to his dead wife.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he obviously doesn't have that energy. I'd say instead of Bond girls, he has Wick friends.
Wick friends, yeah. Or like JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, where the titular JoJos have different JoBros.
John Wick's pals.
John Wick's pals. But the last character I wanted to mention is Nobody.
Yes.
Is that what it's called?
Mr. Nobody.
Mr. Nobody, played by Shamir Anderson, who is really interesting. I want to see more of him. I want to find out more about him. I want a spin-off based on him, because what I saw caught my eye and interested me. It wasn't enough. And I'm glad it wasn't enough, because this is a film that is already juggling a few too many characters to be adding another side story to it. But he is this bounty hunter motivated by an endless ambition to like get as much money as possible out of his targets. And I was wondering whether there was going to be a reveal that he's doing it for a reason. He's not just motivated by greed or the accumulation of wealth, but maybe, I don't know, his dog needs surgery, or he's got a loved one who, I don't know, is held for ransom or something like that, you know, to give him more humanity.
I just think it's gamesmanship. I think it's just economic. It's about, he's from this film. They could add more depth and more motivation later, but at the end of the day, like, these are all a lot of these characters, they're just playing a game.
Oh, that's fair.
And, like, I don't think John Wick was any better than him in his prime.
Oh, no.
So maybe there's an element to which he represents the younger John Wick.
I guess because I'm basically left wanting a spin-off starring him, because I'm so intrigued by this character.
And he's got a cute dog.
And he's got a lovely dog that I'm projecting a lot of, like, complex backstory onto him, where maybe, yeah, he doesn't need that.
I don't think... Wait, I'm sure you could add that if he was the centre of something, but I was very satisfied with what we got, actually.
Oh, for this film, yeah.
I think the actor's very good. I think that character was really interesting. I think that the way that he has a unique spin on interacting with that world is really enjoyable to watch. But I didn't find myself wanting... I'm different here. I didn't find myself wanting more. I think sometimes people can do things for the sake of it.
Well, I guess that...
And like,
he's part of the triangle with John Wick and Kane. And
sure.
He, you know, by the time we get to the end. Obviously, the final confrontation can't be between the three of them. But most of this film felt like the good, the bad, and the ugly type of plot. And well, it was
where
kind
he,
of...
Where he's Eli Wallach.
I don't know who each of them is in well, this
John,
comparison.
No, I do. John Wick is Clint Eastwood. Mm-hmm. Donnie Yen is Lee Van Cleef. Mm-hmm. And I suppose Mr. Nobody is Eli Wallach.
Oh, yeah, because he's the greedy one who's more motivated by...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it is that, actually. Well, you know, Kane is not as evil as the evil or the bad in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But I guess I was kind of expecting it to end on a, like, a three-way Mexican standoff.
No, he... And, not to spoil it, but he mostly sits out the end.
Yeah, and I guess that's my thing. But also, like, I'd be interested to see a spin-off that is not based on an assassin, but is based on a bounty hunter, because there we have, you know, a narrative excuse for him to only go after assassins.
And, like, we know they're making the spin-offs. This isn't us wanting endless content and endless spin-offs of something we like. No, we know they're working on spin-offs.
But as long as they remain good, I want them to be making more. That's the thing. Like, I'm not against, like, you know, franchises constantly churning out products if those products are good. When the products start to wane and these studios have endless money to throw into useless spin-offs that are just as made or bad as the previous ones, then that's when I start complaining.
You know what spin-off I'd like? The employee in one of the Continentals who isn't an assassin and is just going about his day and all this random stupid shit keeps happening to him.
Okay, but the conceit is that they're not aware of it. You just see it in the background. So the whole film is just some guy cleaning rooms and then there's just shit going on in the background.
Well, I think, like, he has his own, like, story. Like, he's maybe in a bad relationship or he's, like, he's got, like, a very human story but set in the world. It'd be very... Or maybe it's just... He doesn't even have a complicated... Maybe it's just Jean Dillman.
Well, if...
But in the assassin's world.
There's a film called The Chambermaid, which is about a chambermaid working in a hotel and we still clean rooms and stuff. That could be it. Or... You know the film you just pitched, what that is, and I'm not even joking. Johnny Stecchino with Roberto Benigni. That's the plot of that film. That he's involved in this huge, like, mafia feud without being aware that he's involved in a mafia feud.
Well, speaking of Benigni, it's also kind of Life is Beautiful.
Yeah.
It's the kid in Life is Beautiful.
Yeah, only there is no cool assassins. It's the Holocaust. It's a bit...
Yeah, which we don't condone.
Yeah, the Holocaust was cringe. Let's put that on the record.
Germany's flop era.
But assassins are cool.
Assassins are always cool. Yeah. If they have a dog. If at some point they have had a dog, they are cool.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that...
That wraps it up.
That pretty
today.
Much wraps it up for today.
Really good film. And one last thing, that scene that everyone has seen, the Hotline Miami, apparently wasn't inspired by Hotline Miami. It was inspired by an older game, which probably in turn inspired Hotline Miami, which is called Hong Kong Massacre. But oh my God, what a fucking setup that was. I was in, like, just mouth agape watching that on the big screen. Also because I didn't see it on Twitter beforehand. It just came out of the blue and that was
it. I avoided... as much as possible. I think I saw a couple of trailers, but I avoided, like, clips and everything and just went in pretty...
Just so happened that after seeing it, first time I went on Twitter, it was just people sharing clips.
Oh, okay.
Regardless of whether I followed them or not.
A few hours made all the difference, seemingly. Yeah. All right, thank you for listening. Our producer, as always, is Jade Corbett. Our artist is Molecule. If you want to follow us on social media, it's at BCUWatchPod on Twitter, at BCUWatchPodcast Instagram. Thank you, Francesco.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening.